Pranessa Seal, the founder and CEO of The Balm in Gilead. The Balm in Gilead is a not-for-profit, non-governmental organization with an international mission to mobilize and educate churches throughout the African diaspora to address HIV. African people, African Americans here in the United States, the Caribbean, and our brothers and sisters living on the mother continent of Africa are disproportionately affected by HIV. One in every 50 black men here in the United States infected with HIV. One in every 160 black women living in the United States infected with HIV. The Caribbean island, the second highest rate of HIV infection in the world, second only to the continent of Africa. Over 20 million Africans infected with HIV on the mother continent. African people, we must do everything that we can to stop the spread of HIV. You have a role to play. Our churches have a role to play. Educate your children. Talk to the people on your job. Let's make every church a center for AIDS education. The video you are about to see is a part of a historical series of historical sermons by renowned pastors in the United States addressing HIV. Thank you for your work in stopping the spread of HIV, and thank you for supporting The Balm in Gilead.
church say amen?
Amen.
Amen. We're grateful, 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 grateful for the invitation to come and speak to this annual gathering, the Balm in Gilead, bringing men and women, clergy persons from across this nation to this beautiful conference center here at Tuskegee University. Those who are affiliated with this great institute of learning should feel proud, as I know they do, of what this institute represents. And I am certainly happy to be here. I haven't been at Tuskegee since 1969. And when I was here then, I was in an altered state of consciousness. So I didn't see it quite the way I see it today. I was a student at Morehouse College, and we came down for a swimming meet. In fact, I didn't have much chance to think about it at all. Some of my partners, Kappa brothers, said, come on, we're going down to a swim meet. I said, well, how are we going? Don't worry about it, just get in the car. So we floated down and floated back. So I'm glad to be here again. Vanessa, God bless you, God bless you, God bless you. Thank you very much. You've been faithful for many, many years, and it has paid off in tremendous ways, tremendous ways. I guess in Matthew, I think, 26th chapter. Matthew 26:6. Brother Hammond, thank you very much for introducing me and making sure I was in the right place. To all of the ministers, pastors, assistants, lay leaders that I've met sitting, drinking tea and talking, it's good to see you. This is the NIV, the New International Version of the book, Biblos Book Bible. And it reads, 26, beginning 6, while Jesus was in Bethany, in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which he poured on his head, and he was reclining at the table. And when the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste, they asked. This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. Aware of this, Jesus said to them, why are you bothering this woman? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Spirit is a strange thing. I wish I could figure it out. It usually winds up causing you to do some very, very strange things. Made David take off all his clothes. Spirit moved upon the waters, brought order out of chaos. It's a rare thing. I have a friend who is a musician. Once he was on stage, he was playing the saxophone and notes were jumping from the horn like jitterbugs on the Savoy dance room floor. And he just got into it. He started twisting his body and whirling, and for about 40 minutes, he just waxed on that saxophone. When it was over, he came backstage. I said, man, what happened to you? Because the audience was in an uproar. They were just applauding, calling him back, tears running down his cheeks. He said, I don't know. It must have been the Holy Ghost. Yeah, I've seen the Spirit do some strange things to people. Joseph was a dreamer, you know, and the Spirit gave him the ability to interpret dreams. And so good was he that Pharaoh changed his name, didn't he? Called him Zophpath-Paaneah. He was a bad brother for a long time. That spirit is spirit. Spirit make you say stuff you don't think you'll say. You know, you'll come out of the wilderness talking about the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. And now. Isn't it true? And it'll make you say things and do things you didn't think you would do. Foaming at the mouth and rolling in the dust. Spirit, you got to watch the spirit. Mary was pregnant from the Holy Ghost. Got baby-making power. That's right, isn't it? So you got to watch the spirit. And the spirit said to me, and I was wondering if it was right, but you know, you don't question the spirit. You try to discern between spirits. But when you believe that it is the spirit of the Lord, so I said, Lord, what is it? He said, this is what I want you to talk about today. What? He said, sex and drugs. First topic I like very much. It doesn't make much sense for me to try to stand here and lie to y'all. I'm crazy about sex. I ain't gonna tell you no lie. In fact, when I went to the Bible, and I'm into this. I want you to listen to me. When I went to the Bible, I went over to Genesis, and God created paradise, Eden. Eden literally means delight. And I don't see how it can be paradise or delightful unless they had sex. And the one thing that's a problem with Christian theology and its interpretation is that the recording of the Genesis story has Adam and Eve to know each other after they were expelled from paradise. And that's a problem for you ministers and clergy persons, lay leaders. That's a problem because the church has, in the West at least, always viewed sex as something sinful and dirty and something that God had not ordained for paradise. I don't understand how the church could make that leap, because while in paradise, they were instructed to what? There you go. Be fruitful. But the actual knowing of Adam to Eve and Eve to Adam, Adam of Eve of Adam, did not take place until after the fall. So therefore, for centuries, millennia, the church has always characterized sex as being sinful and dirty, something to be avoided. And only if you couldn't avoid it, particularly for those of us in clergy, were you to get married. If you're going to burn, the apostle said, then get married. Somehow, if you can keep the fire from raging, and I ain't been able to figure it out how to keep the fire from raging. It's like a fire, yes, shut up in my bones. And I can't hold it in. So sex is all right with me. I can take it out of that sinful, dirty context and see it actually in the light in which I think God intended it. Something beautiful, something delightful. And one of the problems that we have in discussing HIV and AIDS is this inhibition that we have with sex. It has only been recently, thank God for you, Pernessa. It has only been recently that we have been able to talk, and we still can't talk like we ought to in the church about sex. Sex. I remember getting up one Sunday morning and just standing there and took my text, and I said, the first word I have to say to you all this morning, sex. Deaconess's eyes got big. Diggies didn't know what to expect. And I wanted to talk to them about sex. I wanted to talk to the children about sex. I wanted it to be in the context of the God that created sex. And one of the great problems that we have today is that we allow everybody to talk about sex, but the people of the God who created sex. And that's a problem. It's a problem. So when it came time to come to grips in the church with HIV/AIDS, particularly as it first came to us as a disease of the gay community, we had trouble. Not so much because it came from the gay community, but because we had trouble talking about sex, period. Couldn't talk about it. I'm a Baptist. And obviously I'm colored, black, Negro, African American. Every black preacher I know has sex. Most of the time more than the parishioners want him to. And while there is a kind of light feeling to this, while we laugh, you know that we laugh because we know the seriousness of the matter. Everybody wants to cloak it in all kinds of clandestine language. Everybody wants to talk about it as it is enigmatic and puzzling. There's nothing puzzling about it. When your libido rises, you know what to do. Unfortunately, many of us, because the church has not taken the time to talk to us about it, we had to go through a period of hit and miss, didn't we? We didn't know what to do. We didn't know what to think. Initially, we confused love with sex. How many of us have heard the words, "I love you," and allowed the deepest intimacies to be revealed, only to discover that there was no real link? We didn't talk about it. I remember really being with my wife when my three children were growing up, and we were watching Sesame Street. It was the rage of the day. And they said, "This is your ear. This is your arm. This is your leg. This is the elbow. This is the knee." And, you know, with Big Bird, whoever it was, we'd be singing right along. And I said, "Baby, listen, we got more than knees and ears and elbow." So, you know, that's how these knuckleheads got here. So who is it that defines for them? You couldn't talk about it in school. Sex education was a no-no. You know, only recently has it been pushing through, and we weren't talking about it in church. The black church especially was not talking about it. And we were aware of the various sexual orientations in our congregations. There was no question about that. We knew that there were gay men and gay women. We knew that there was adultery going on. We knew that there was all kinds of clandestine relationships, but we weren't talking about it. And therefore, where do you think it led? Let the children. They didn't know. They had to find out like you did, hit or miss. And you coming down hard on the kids because they're coming up pregnant, and the only difference between you and them is you didn't get caught. Either you didn't get caught or you wasn't getting none. It's just that simple. That's right. And at least in those days, our mothers and fathers were trying, some of them, to tell us, "You know, wear your raincoat, boy." Trying to warn us about not only the dangers of pregnancy, but also the dangers of the venereal diseases at that time, syphilis and gonorrhea. But it was not as widespread as it should have been. And especially in the place where most of us gather, where the free talk and the power that allows us to understand was coming forth from the pulpits, from the churches, from the Sunday schools. Sex education, nothing wrong with it. God created it. God made it. And where else but in the house of God do we talk about sex? Now, over here in the text, it's interesting, this sex and drugs along with the discussion of AIDS. Leprosy it seems to me, was the AIDS of Jesus' day. It was a feared disease. People didn't understand it. They didn't want to go around lepers. Lepers were ostracized. They were put in their own colonies. You see? Misunderstood, except for Jesus. Thank God for Jesus. Looks beyond our faults and sees our needs. Thank God for Jesus. Jesus, the one who is able to break through every barrier and have straight talk. He stayed just before he was crucified in the home of Simon the leper. Now, you got to go back to the 8th chapter of Matthew to really get the story. He'd just come down from the mountain. And there was one, said, you know, and he healed him. He was grateful. Jesus went to his home, stayed in the home of Simon the leper. And while he was there with this AIDS victim, a woman came. Now, this is interesting because the story varies from gospel to gospel. Here in Matthew, his head is anointed. Over in another gospel, it's his feet. And the interesting thing about this is that the woman's tears in one gospel is just flooding down and covering his feet. And then she takes her hair. Some of us would have to be careful. She takes her hair and wipes his feet. Now, I had to sit back and imagine that. And I said, if there is anything more erotic in the Bible, I want to know where it is. First of all, the woman was a woman who had a bad reputation. Or a good one, depending on who you were. And she was there in the home of the leper. First of all, the thing that we've got to recognize, these strange friends that Jesus had. Now, these were not the ordinary friends of a high-minded preacher. You know, this preacher, this bishop, you know, we got all kinds of titles. I don't know what to call half of y'all in here. Reverend, bishop, I don't know what you are. As far as I'm concerned, you like me. We all sinners saved by grace, trying to get to heaven the best way we can. But listen. He had a strength. First of all, he was in the home of a man who had AIDS. Now, how did he get AIDS? That's what all the friends outside wanted to know. I thought I knew Simon. You mean to tell me? How did he get AIDS? He had a girlfriend, he got a wife. What you mean? Well, you know, he had a blood transfusion. But did that get, well, how did he get AIDS? He seemed like a nice fella. How did he get AIDS? And he got the preacher over there in his house. And then this woman comes by. Who are these strange people Jesus is hanging out with? Who are all these folk in this room concerned about AIDS? You know, we're preachers, we're lay people, we're men, we're women. We're straight, we're gay. Who are we? And Jesus never really worried about who we are. The one thing I'm concerned about is all of these bona fide tartuffes, that's a fancy word for hypocrites, who are so concerned about the contradictions that they perceive. Jesus never had these contradictions. He was in the home of a man who was a leper, dealing with a woman who had been a prostitute, dealing with him in an erotic way. And there he was. So here we are with this strange gathering, this erotic encounter in a house of a man with AIDS. And the only thing that overcomes whatever that woman was and Simon with his leprosy, his AIDS, was the love of God. God loved them both. Wasn't afraid to touch them. Wasn't afraid to eat with them. Wasn't afraid to talk with them. and loved him so much and recognized their love for him so much, he could have gone anyway. He could have gone to Joseph of Arimathea's home. He could have hung out with Nicodemus. He could have gone any number of places. He could have gone back with Mary and Martha, but he decided to go to Simon's house. He was sending a message saying that these are the people who are the lights of the world, the salt of the earth. And I don't care what kind of disease they have. I don't care what kind of background they have. I love them. And to us in the church, that's a clear message. We're not supposed to ask all of these crazy questions. It's about the love of everybody that comes to us. Try to help them. And even when we're at our lowest moment, we will find refuge and strength, anointing and healing. It comes from places we never even expected it. I think it was Bishop Bean who told me the story of how he used to play at his church. He said he'd play so much that the church would just get happy. He said, whenever the service seemed to be lagging, he'd run to the piano and play and sing, and the folk would rev right up. He said, then the preacher, which we are often known to do, remembered he had an engagement that afternoon down the road a piece, and he forgot about it, needed a choir. Bean said that was all right. He'd pull together four or five people and get on in the bus and the cars, and they'd run on down the road with the preacher. Just preach and holler and sing and have a good old time. Said then this thing called AIDS hit. He said the same people who were willing to shout, help the church get happy, said the preacher wouldn't go to see him. Wouldn't visit him. Now we come a long way, but not as far as we need to. With a clear and open discussion about sex. And sex, you know, let me just, this thing, prostate cancer is going, you know, it's a worry to some of us. Many of us were glad for the break between sessions because we had to take a prostate break, you know. I remember going to the doctor the first time for this exam, and the doctor said, we can do the PSA exam, but you need the digital exam. I said, well, doc, you know, I'm not down with this digital stuff. He said, well, if you really want to have a decent exam, we got to do it that way. So I said, well, all right. I said, what you want me to do? He said, grab your ankle. And after them hollering and screaming, he said, it seemed like it's all right. Then he started asking me some questions. He said, how often do you have sex? I said, what? He said, how often do you have sex? How many times a week? I said, oh, about 9 or 10. He looked at me and said, what, Reverend? I said, well, about 4 or 5. He said, Reverend, look, he said, pull your chair up a little closer to the desk. Let's talk about this thing. When I finally admitted the truth, he said, all right. He said, that sounds more like it. I said, tell me, doctor, I have often heard that men develop prostate cancer. We're talking about sex now. Some people who are so pristine in their Christianity can't stand it. But unless you learn to talk about it and relax with it, you're not going to get to solving the problem of the transmission of AIDS. I hope you understand what I mean. I'm not through. I got drugs to go through yet. But I said in the barber shop, they said that brothers who come down with prostate cancer get it because they're really not, you know, getting enough. He said, no, Reverend, that's not it. I said, well, what is it? He said, you know, the gland contracts and it expands. And he said, just like any other gland or muscle, you know, regular activity will keep it healthy. And he said, it's not how much you get or don't get. He said, it is the regularity with which you get it. And he said, and if that muscle is contracting and expanding on a regular basis, then it is more likely to remain healthy. So he said, what you need to do is fall into a rhythm and stay there. I said, go away from here. You can't mean that. He said, yes, to fall into a rhythm and stay there. He said, that way you're working that muscle on a regular basis, that gland on a regular basis. That was plain talk. That was the clearest thing. I went back and told the congregation right away. Deacon started looking up at me. I said, listen, man, we're trying to share with you things that will be beneficial to your health and the health of our community. And plus, you're looking at me like a cow looking at a new fence. It'll make your wife a whole lot happier, too. It's frank talk. It's the ease with which we can discuss these personal matters that will help us to deal with the inhibitions that and the taboos that have encircled us and allow us to operate with the love of Jesus. Jesus knew who this woman he was. He knew all about her, but he also understood what he knew. And it was no threat to him. And he understood her act not as one of erotica, but as one of love and grace, because he had delivered her. He had delivered her. I met a brother just sitting out there sipping tea. He said, the Lord has delivered me. And he is the kind of witness that we need to move in and out of our communities, up and down the breadth and length of this land, telling men and women the real deal, talking to our children directly. People ask me what I think about these things, and Vanessa reminded me, I said, Vanessa, how long ago was it when I started with you? She said it was in 1990, and she said it was your statement at the St. James Presbyterian Church that kids ought to have condoms, I think it was, that hit the times and said it changed things a whole lot. And many of the preachers got mad at me and said, no, we got to talk about abstinence. And once again, I said, but baby, you don't abstain. And I said, and if you're going to talk about abstinence, you might as well break it on down. So talk about masturbation too. Talk about masturbation too. It's a reality. I don't want to get into your business, but I got enough amens to make me know that it's a reality. And if your hormones are jumping and if you can't make it, talk to children about alternatives. Your children won't be born insane or deformed. Talk to them. You don't want them to get pregnant before time. You want them to be able to let some release go. Talk to them. Provide them with the alternatives. And talk to them as men and women who love God. And love them. Because if you say you love God and you don't help your brother, then the blood is on your hands or your sister. It's frank talk. So in our Sunday school curriculum, from our pulpits, in our Bible classes, we ought to take the time to talk about sex. They say, well, what about homosexuality? Well, I got my own ideas about that. But I tell you what I do encourage. If you are gay, be monogamous. If you are gay, don't, the promiscuity is the same. Hetero, homosexual. Don't be out here running around. And begin to talk about your own sexuality. Oh, I would to God that more and more of you could talk about it with your pastor. But we need men and women in the churches who can talk to people about their sexuality. I had to talk to a man about his sexuality, bisexual. I said, but brother, you can't keep this up. Now, you got to make up your mind. You got to get this thing worked out because you got a wife and three children. And you got to put this thing in line. Because you're dangerous not only to yourself, but to her, your children, and everybody else.
Oh, would to God that we could talk to our churches, our pastors, about our sexuality. That thing which rages on the inside of us. The thing which drives us. It makes you do things you didn't think you would do. Sex. And in the battle against HIV/AIDS, it's an important discussion. One that Jesus talked about. He talked about the relationship. He talked about adultery very openly. And he put it at a higher level. The spirit, he said, what? Adultery, don't even look at somebody with lust. And all of us are adulterous in that regard. It's hot in Alabama. I just want you in the context of the church. Your style is different from mine, and your congregation is different from mine. One of the great pleasures that I have is I come from a congregation where they had Adam Clayton Powell Jr. as the pastor. Adam was smart. He was the greatest congressperson our country has ever seen. He produced more pieces of legislation than any other congressperson. But Adam had a kind of free-willing spirit. I don't necessarily agree with what he did, but at least he provided an opportunity and a space where you could talk about things in a relaxed and comfortable way so that you could help the children to understand that they have more than noses and ears and elbows, that they've got some other God-made things that are wonderful and delightful if you know how to use them properly. And that they've got a place when they have trouble with their sexuality to come and find somebody who's got an understanding ear, somebody who is not judgmental. When they came to Jesus, he was understanding. In fact, some people are still trying to figure out, because in this same scene and in some other scenes, they say that Jesus was reclining at the table. Now, I like that, because I like to eat like that when I'm around friends and you can just lay back and relax. In another scene, they have the disciple that Jesus loved with his head against his breast. People are still wrestling with that. So this question about sexuality and orientation, don't let that be something that you just don't want to discuss, that you just want to draw the line on and tell people where you stand. If you are the man or woman of God through Christ, your heart must be open. And you must be willing to receive. Then, once you've been able to receive, you will be able to help and provide guidance and instruction and help us to win this war against HIV/AIDS. Drugs. Sex and drugs. Now, I told you that I was in an altered state of consciousness when I came down here the first time. That's what I was talking about. I was high. And it's amazing. For those of you, I'm 50, and some of you may be in my category, a little older, a little younger, but when I was at Morehouse, when I was down in the South, when I was in college, as many of you were, wherever it was, smoking marijuana was the rage. People used to smoke marijuana all the time, still do. Among other things. But I often think, just as I said about you not being caught in your sexual misconduct, I often think, what would have happened if crack had showed up then? And I must confess that I would have had my trials with it. I must confess that I might have been a statistic. And in this whole connection between drugs and sex, we all know that when you're high, when you're in an altered state of consciousness, whether it's marijuana, whether it's crack, whether it's cocaine, perhaps not heroin because that just makes you sleepy and drowsy, but otherwise, even for a point with alcohol, you think that you can perform wonders sexually. The operative word is think. But how many of us and how many of our children are caught up in this cycle of drugs and sex so that when they are filled with the drug, when they are in the altered state of consciousness, being bombarded with the symbols of an erotic society that's hung up on sex, What do? They engage in it. Oh, openly. That's why we've got to talk to them. They engage in it unashamedly. That's why we got to talk to them. They engage in it without the use of condoms and other protective material because their libidos are raging, their hormones are jumping, and they're trying their best to express themselves as adults, believing that love and sex is the same thing. The lie still abounds. And with that kind of attitude, it's bad enough to have to deal with sex by itself. But when you've got to deal with drugs and sex, we've got an issue. And we can't be hypocritical about this. See, we can't sip scotch and bourbon and rum and gin, wine, and tell the children not to smoke marijuana. There's a disconnect there. And so in order for us to be consistent, we have got to reject all psychotropic drugs. It is consistent now. We go to the Apostle Paul. Paul talked about eating meat. He said, now, you should not eat meat sacrificed to idols. Paul said, but I can eat it, you know, because I know the idol doesn't mean anything. But if my brother, who doesn't quite understand that, sees me eating meat, I become a stumbling block. So Paul declared, meat I will not eat while the world standeth. Oh, yeah, I know. I smoked enough marijuana, drank enough wine. I could drink and smoke with the best of them. Probably still drive from here to New York without an accident. You know how them brothers, they give me a pint of scotch and put me on the road. I'll burn up that highway between New York and South Carolina. You know how they talk. But the point here is, here I am, a preacher of the Most High God, knowing maybe I can drink. But that's not the point if a weaker brother or sister spies me with a glass of wine, a scotch in my hand, I become a stumbling block. You can't be hypocritical about this because it's killing us in terms of what it does to make us weak. It breaks the fetters of our consciousness. It loosens us and makes us easy. And it is in that sexual high sexual engagement that we are spreading HIV, drugs. You know, I'm concerned, beloved, about the war on drugs. It's not working. The only thing the war on drugs is doing is locking up more and more of our young men and women. It's not working. And the question I have is why is one psychotropic drug more illegal or carries more weight than another psychotropic drug? How you gonna get more time for crack than you get for powdered cocaine? And in this discussion, and we can deal with that at another level, but I want to raise this whole discussion of drugs and the war on drugs as a red flag, because it is precisely drugs, intravenously taken drugs, as well as the others, because they loosen us, as I say, to engage in this promiscuity that's helping to spread HIV/AIDS. But also the intravenous drugs. Oh, beloved, what can we do? I believe in abstinence. But what you gonna do? Love says that something else is necessary. Oh, I know that I would preach, stay away from drugs, but preach till I'm blue in the face. Drug abuse is on the rise in the nation. And our children are snorting and smoking and injecting and in injecting and in smoking and in snorting, spreading HIV. So the dangers that attack them and us are coming from all directions. There's got to be another answer. The criminal element against drugs is not the right way to go. Soon, 2 million will become 3. And our nation, already the largest population in prison in the world, will continue to grow, and it'll be, as Richard said, just us. So in the church, I tell you, my beloved brothers and sisters, think carefully now about the whole notion of decriminalizing and making it easier for men and women, if they're going to use drugs, to have available those things that will not spread the double whammy of drugs and AIDS. Because if we don't think that way, they'll continue to lock up our children. And this disease will continue to chew us up. And you know, it's interesting how they deal with drugs, because you can get any kind of illegal drug over here. The war, we're losing the war. We lost the war. But you can't get the life-saving drugs that you need in Africa. Sex and drugs, it's a little different spin on drugs. You can get anything that'll kill you, but you can't get that which will help you. Even here in our own country, in the poor communities where the drugs are necessary, it's hard to get. Hypocrites. You call for the, you say you're against abortion, but you want the death penalty. That's hypocritical. You say you were against drugs, but you allow them to promote the consumption of alcohol. And then you say you want to fight AIDS, but the healing measures that we have thus far denied people because of a lack of money. That woman, that sexy woman, in the home of a leper, took an alabaster box filled with sweet perfume and anointed the body of Jesus. The disciples protested, jumped up. What is it? Man, if you could take that money and feed the poor. Jesus said, come on, baby. What she's doing for me is going to be a memorial for her. What do you mean, Reverend, a memorial? This woman was willing to waste, as some might call it, the anointment of that expensive perfume on Jesus. But what she was doing was really healing for the whole world. This country of ours, concerned about austerity, concerned about saving, really are not doing it for the poor. And it is our concern that we take that alabaster box filled with anointment and pour it over those who are in desperate need of healing. That's like the healing oil, huh? That sweet perfume. You know, your preachers in the church, they got them olive oil under there, they fling out on y'all every night. Y'all caught up in the spirit, y'all know what kind of oil it is. I was down in Southwest Georgia when I was a little boy, and I had the sore eyes, pink eyes, conjunctivitis. And they took, my grandmama took me to a bishop who was in the backwoods healing. Now, he had a big tent, man, and it was just filled up with people. They were shouting and jumping. My grandmama brought me up. He's going to heal me. Put his hand over my eye. Heal! He said, I'm going to drop some holy water in the boy's eyes. Murine. Heal! There was a need for murine, even with the healing man of God. And there is a need for these drugs, even with the healing men and women of God. There's a need for it. And if you can get every other kind of drug and for it, you're sending our children to jail, and you can't get the drugs that we need in order to sustain our lives. Magic is a marvelous example, but he got money and time. And quiet as it's kept, he still got AIDS. Drugs and sex. The different attitude we've got to have about drugs. No, don't use them. Preach abstinence until your throat is sore. Fight against our children being wrapped up in them, but fight against all drugs. And then lift up the voice of the black church for our brothers and sisters. I'm Baptist National. And when we talk about foreign, our global mission, huh? We talked about the work that we tried to do in Africa. Well, right now, there seems to me no more important work than to talk about the unleashing of these drugs that our brothers and sisters can have them. Thank God for the Bristol Myers and the others who are trying to do what they can, but even that is not enough. Our government, you want to talk about foreign policy, not only if first charity begins at home and then it spreads abroad. Somebody said, is it conspiracy? You think it's conspiracy? I say, well, conspiracy, I mean, yeah, I'm the conspiratory Negro, you know. said, man was sitting down, he was trying to figure out the law of the country, and he said, you are 3/5 of a human being. I studied every possible history book to see if somebody said that his hand slipped or that they made a mistake. It was deliberate. Deliberate. Jim Crow laws, deliberate. A black man or woman has no rights that any white person is bound to respect. That was deliberate. Tuskegee, the experiment, deliberate. So when you test me about conspiracy, I'll tell you quickly, I don't know. I can't say for sure, but I tell you, I got enough history to back me up if I wanted to pick it up. The drugs that flow through our community, we don't manufacture any drugs. So if you wanted to ask me, I can tell you this whole question of drugs seems mighty suspicious to me. And then you're locking up all my children. Then I've got to fight with the terrible disease, HIV/AIDS. So yes, I come to you today using Jesus and that woman and Simon. Yes, I come to you today talking about sex and drugs in every context as a preacher of the Most High God. Yes, I'm pleading with you. I'm talking plainly to you. I'm your brother. I'm nobody. I'm a sinner saved by grace just like you are. I'm out here struggling every day. I make mistakes. I come back. When we first got into this AIDS thing, I didn't know what it was. I was as scared as anybody else. Oh, but by the glory of God and through the movement of the Holy Spirit, open my eyes, illumine me. Help me to see a bit more clearly. And help me to recognize that as God loved me, so I must love everybody else. And it made me glad for a moment. Some of you saw in Jet, I took that AIDS test with Dennis Haysbert out in front of the church. And that wasn't easy. My wife said, don't talk like that. You make people think you've been promiscuous. I said, but baby, listen. That ain't easy to stand up there and take a test before the world. A preacher, because you see, whatever comes out of it, the world going to know immediately. One thing I can, you, my brothers and sisters who are clergy persons know, once they get some dirt on the preacher, it spreads like wildfire. So I was nervous. They had this new Orisha test, you know, they stick the thing between your gum and your lip. And I sat there, and the man, I said, how soon you going to know? Then they sent the guy up to the office before, because they counsel you before. They begin to tell you what it might be like if it comes back positive. And I started listening to him. And I started to perspire. I got nervous. He said, we don't want you to get nervous, Reverend. You probably have nothing to worry about, but just in case. So I waited. And then they parked the van 2 Sundays afterward in front of the church. And I remember preaching the 9 o'clock service. We had a great time. And I looked out of my office window and saw the van. So they said, you go up into the van and sit down and they will give you the report. And I went up and sat down. And the man said, oh, Reverend, everything's fine. I came back negative. But you can't imagine. Maybe you can. The load that was lifted. I went back and tried to preach the same sermon, but oh, it was so much different. Whoa, it was so much. You know, and it told me something. It told me that there are a lot of our brothers and sisters out there who are scared. They know they need the test, but they needed somebody like their pastor to take the lead. And I started asking them, I said, have you had your AIDS test today? Yeah, but Pastor, we went on ahead. So you did it. We figured we could make it too. I said, you mean you were waiting for me? Not necessarily waiting for you, but when we saw you do it, we felt a little bit better. And we figured if you were willing to do it with your exposure, we could do it because we're not as exposed as you are. And I started hearing more and more of that. And I started to talk more frankly about sex and drugs and talk to our children about it. And they listened. Children say, Reverend Bunch, you mean to tell me you got high? I say, yes, baby, I did. And I'm going to tell you, if I could go back and change it now, I'd change every bit of it. I said it was risky. It was dangerous. I didn't necessarily have to be here. You're so precious. You're so beautiful. I said, but Reverend, I don't know what to do. Sometimes I'm out with my friends, and that feeling starts coming on. I said, talk to me. Talk to me. Brother said, yeah, Reverend, I don't know what to do. I said, well, you know, there are all kinds of alternatives. I said, what you mean, Reverend? And I sit down and I talk with him. I showed him the story about the sin of Onan, you know, when they believed that the man carried the seed and he masturbated and he spilled the seed on the floor and it was a sin against God. I talked to them about that. I showed it to them right there in the book. I wanted them to see and understand. I showed them Paul. Paul said it is better to marry than to burn. And I told them what it meant to burn, to be filled with emotion and lust. I talked to them frankly because I want them to understand that they're not the first ones to go through it, and it can be dealt with. And I talk to them about drugs, and I tell them why I don't drink, why I don't smoke, and I tell them the difference, and I cast it all in terms of my love for them through God who loved me, because it was only by the grace. That's when I started. It was only by the grace. That's when all the other stuff goes away and I just turn my life over to God. It was only by his grace that I'm able to stand before you today. It was his grace that saved me. I didn't deserve any of it. I should have been in hell. But it was love that lifted me. When I look around at this conference and see those of you who are gathered here from across the nation, pastors and lay leaders, clergy persons, I'm filled up because I know what the struggle has been like all along. I remember Pernessa. I remember Deborah and all of those when it was anathema. We couldn't even talk about it. They were begging preachers and churches to come. Now I come down to Tuskegee, Alabama, and see all of you all sitting out here looking good. I can see it. You know, the Bible talks about, I started in Genesis, let me come over to Revelation, a new heaven and a new earth. I can see a new world to come. We're going to beat AIDS. I'm sure of it. We got hepatitis C. We're going to beat it all. And the reason I know it is because I can see it. It's coming out full blown. What does the book say? It says the whole world travaileth and groaneth in pain, waiting for the day to be delivered. You know what I'm talking about. My children, my first child anyway, was born in Atlanta, and I was so happy. My wife went into labor. I went right to the hospital with her. Now, I hadn't had any Le Mans classes, none of that stuff. I was just a bad young brother, and I was going to be there and watch my baby be born. They rolled my wife into this big room, and the only thing they had separating her from three or four other women were these curtains that you just pull around the bed, the labor room. And she was not ready, really, to give birth at that moment, but the woman next to her was. And her husband or boyfriend was there, so I just figured, well, baby, you know, you're going to be a few more minutes. Let me peep around here and see what, see what's going on. Now, I mean, you sisters are something, huh? Sisters, legs up in the air, spread out. Doctor standing there, and one nurse down by her head, another nurse there between her legs, and the nurse up by her head talking about, push. That woman said, ugh. Women are something, man, I tell you. Push, darling. You can see her grabbing onto the side of the bed, pulling the sheet. Push! Blood popping out, perspiration everywhere. Push! That poor woman was pushing. Then her husband did a bad thing. He said, baby, are you all right? She called him everything but a child of God. I can't even repeat what that woman said up here. Lord, did she cuss that man. And about that time he saw me, he snatched the curtain around. And then I, you know, he got back into it and I said, push. I peeped back around. So finally, you could see the head coming through the womb. Oh, it was something. I was arrested by it all, mesmerized, hypnotized. You could see it. And then the nurse at the head said, "Come on, darling, just one more time." She grabbed hold to the side of the bed, cried out in her strongest voice, "Ah!" And that baby shot out blood and mucus everywhere. Proof. They caught the baby, cut the umbilical cord, wiped the mucus and blood from him, and laid him down right next to his mom. And what does the Bible say? It was marvelous in our eyes. Oh, it was something. And so when I got here to Tuskegee and I walked in the room and I looked around and I saw all these people and I thought back, Vanessa, 10 years. I thought back. I thought about the pain and the labor. I thought about the hard work and the fundraising. I thought about trying to convince preachers to come together. And when I walked in the room and walked up on the podium, I can see the head. It's right there. Something new is about to happen. God is speaking to us. The whole world groaneth and travaileth. It's about to happen. We're going to win this victory. And I love this brother so much. He's dead and gone now. He was one of my heroes in the 60s. And he had a sweet voice. And he had two other brothers singing with him. His name was Curtis Mayfield. You know, y'all old as me, you remember. Curtis Mayfield. And that's right, and I saw that woman, and that's the only thing that I leave you with. I told you when I was out there, I said, I can't tell y'all nothing. Y'all already know what I'm talking about. You all preachers of the Most High God. You all church people. I saw you up shouting a moment ago. You all know what we have to do. Vanessa just brought me here as a kind of validation to take you into a talk about sex and drugs around the whole question of AIDS, but you know what you have to do. So remember what Curtis and the Impressions used to say. Just keep on pushing. That's all. You can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way, somehow, because I got my strength. And it don't make sense not to keep on pushing.